Shane Burley is the author of the book Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. He writes on a range of political topics, and his work has been published by Truthout, NBC News, Al Jazeera, and other publications. So, Shane, just this week, two noted historians of fascism, both experts in their field, Timothy Snyder and Robert Paxton, called both Donald Trump and the attack on the U.S. Capitol last week as fascist. You've written extensively on the far right and fascists over the years. How did we get to this point, and were you surprised at all by how events unfolded last week?
No, I wasn't tremendously surprised. I think what both the experts you mentioned are picking up on is the kind of paramilitary quality of it. And I know that Paxton specifically had cited a certain unwillingness to call Trump a fascist without having sort of a paramilitary squad there to back him, and this kind of appears as such, and I'm sure that's probably true of the Snyder analysis. I think the way that I might differentiate from that is that I don't necessarily, I think that the ideological tendencies are there even when they're not fully manifest, and so what's happening here, it's been largely called a coup attempt, but I wouldn't say it's organized enough to necessarily call it that. It has a little bit more impulsivity to it, and it organizes itself a little bit more like a social network. And so that has been building, well, you know, at least for the last 5 years of Trumpism, but even longer into the Tea Party and beyond that in just kind of far-right populist movements, let's go back decades. So this was all that kind of impulsive, seemingly spontaneous, but not entirely spontaneous, kind of acts of violence, and Trump's connection to it has been there for a very long time now. And so there should have been nothing surprising about a president who has cultivated a cult-like violent following than saying that a conspiratorial cabal has taken over the government. I mean, that just logically would precede acts of semi-organized violence from the followers.
In last week, so there are members of the fascist street gang. I know you've written about the Proud Boys and other Trump supporters attacked Black Lives Matter activists and counter-demonstrators in Albany. And in the brawl that ensued, one anti-fascist stabbed some of the Proud Boys in an act of self-defense. He was later arrested by the police, and a Black Lives Matter activist was also brutalized and arrested by state police that afternoon. And this happened, you know, the same time that the siege on the Capitol in D.C. happened. But none of the Proud Boys were arrested by the police, and counter-demonstrators feel like the police essentially enabled the violence of the Proud Boys. So I think this incident sheds light on a national trend, and one certainly unfolding right now in D.C., that law enforcement is much more lenient in responding to violence or the threat of violence from the far right and fascists than they are in responding to protests and movements, you know, on the left, even peaceful ones, and that there is a definite crossover and even in some instances, coordination from both vigilante fascist groups and law enforcement. Can you talk about this and tell us what trends you've noticed and written about both nationally, but also in Portland, where you're based?
Yeah, I mean, the police play kid gloves with the Proud Boys. It's not only the Proud Boys, most far-right groups. In general, there's a lot of historical reasons for this. I mean, the white vigilante groups are not disconnected or at pure odds with the police. This goes back for a very long time, where law enforcement tacitly either above ground and clearly above ground ways or in covert ways or even just in ideologically congruent ways will support these far-right groups as sort of the guardians of the social order to a degree. I think that sometimes people look for explicit coordination as the evidence of it, or they allege explicit coordination when I think that in a way white supremacy is more insidious than that, in as much as a largely white police force that who is structurally there to maintain systems of property, white supremacy, only have the ability to see themselves in more of a collaborative relationship with far-right groups than with left-wing groups. They literally have more ideological overlap. They have more constituents that overlap. They speak a more of a common language. The far-right groups there try to coordinate with the police. So there's just a lot more reasons why the police tend to see allyship in the far-right, and they won't see it in the left, who also see enemies. So it's, I think it's just, it's sort of built into the structure of it. There's been a lot of kind of reports about the police basically saying they see like far right groups as more mainstream than left wing groups, where their police unions, the largest organizations that are propping up police interests, are basically supporting the same ideological positions as the Proud Boys. There's a lot of reasons why the Proud Boys are not getting treated with that kind of force. There is also a certain type of historical clash between the police and white nationalist groups. This is felt really heavily in like the 1980s and early 90s with the militia movement and police busting them up and kind of FBI stings on white supremacist groups. But that was specifically around their open revolutionary politics. And with the Proud Boys, they work a little bit differently. A lot of the groups that we saw in Washington, D.C., that's from the Capitol, works a little bit differently. They actually see themselves as quote-unquote constituents of the existing country to a degree, rather than having a kind of very explicit, open revolutionary politics. That may be changing as Biden takes office, but those moments of clash between the police and the far right aren't really happening right now in the same way. And like I said, that nice shift has the Biden administration changes the perception of what the government is in these groups. I guess we'll have to see with that. But I think what's happening is that the common narrative inside the Proud Boys is also the one that's inside police departments. Conspiratorial views of Black Lives Matter protesters and Antifa, a really confused understanding of what's real and what's not. QAnon is just blazing a trail through police departments right now. So I think there's a very... We need to understand that there's enough commonalities there that we cannot expect that police departments are the comprehensive solution to dealing with something like the Proud Boys. They never have been. They never will be.
So how dangerous and volatile is the current political moment, and how does it compare to past fascist movements, either in this country or in other countries?
Yeah, I think some of the conversation, I think, is a little bit wrongheaded. There's a couple of reasons why. One is that that people are using the term coup, they're using the term violent insurrection, they're using the term terrorist, even though they really shouldn't. And I think they're doing that for reasons that are not very accurate in some ways and not very useful in others. They do it largely to try and position Trump supporters with the same rhetoric that Trump supporters have positioned the left, to say, oh, actually, these are the rioters. These are the insurrectionaries. These are the ones that are dangerous to law and order, right? And so what they're doing is essentially capitulating to a right-wing vision of the world and then ascribing the enemy status to this group of people. And the problem is that they are much more diffuse, less organized, and less of a have any kind of cohesive political agenda that you might see historically in like a fascist party that you might have had in the 30s or something. So it's not really a one-to-one comparison. That being said, none of them are one-to-one comparisons because it's 2021 and the world doesn't work the way it did in fascist coups in years past. Social movements work profoundly different. For example, party politics aren't as important. Neither are formal organizations. Mass movements develop themselves through different metrics. They coordinate differently. They think of themselves differently. They identify themselves differently. And so a large-scale kind of insurrection that could lead to a revolutionary moment would look more like it did in Washington, D.C. or Minneapolis or somewhere than it would look like the beer hall putsch. And so I think that we can't just analogize it to something else perfectly. I think what's most dangerous right now is not that they're about to overthrow the government. I don't see a lot of evidence that that's the case. I think what's dangerous right now is the normalization of far-right violence as legitimate political action beyond just theater. That's important. The message of desperation that's going on at the far-right right now as a kind of combination between losing the election and their the escalation of conspiracy theories leads to seemingly impulsive acts of violence, kind of what people call, maybe rightly or wrongly, lone wolf attacks. That's, I think, a really big fear. I think that the narrative that these people are the rightful defenders of the American project, and that project is under attack from, who knows, communists, Antifa, whatever, that is really dangerous because that leads to these kind of violent interventions. I think that's the framework in which we need to understand it, not as Trump right now is going to successfully stage a revolutionary coup on the government. I mean, the American state is a very large capitulate to what we think will be rhetorically useful in talking about far-right groups instead of trying to see them as accurately as possible.
So what advice do you have for people in effectively fighting both the far-right and, you know, far-right populist and fascist movements?
I mean, I think self-defense is a critical piece of that. I think community coordination. I mean, it's in a way it's kind of boring because the answer I give to people is to organize in organizations that exist. I mean, that's the most important thing, is to look at what organizations exist, find ways of connecting them and creating intersectional analysis and collaborating through coalition building. Those are the important things. You know, we have organizations that exist. We need to be able to pivot them so that they have self-defense components where they have the ability to fight. This happens on multiple fronts. We can't just defend against the Proud Boys of the streets, but we absolutely have to. We have to be looking at a kind of border imperialism. We have to be able to look at what's happening in workplaces and ecologically. Like, we have to connect those together. And so I actually think that imperfect action is better than perfect inaction. And so I think that people need to see where they're at, see what they're good at, see what they like doing, and then to take action like that. But you always have to have a rear guard component to it. Anti-fascism is not just a movement in itself. It's what protects all movements going forward. And it's even more than that. It's what protects the impulse towards creating liberation. You know, one of the things that white nationalism is about false promises and about the kind of twisting and perversion of the impulse to destroy that which you think is destroying you. And so anti-fascism is absolutely critical, just like having a core sense of anti-racism and opposition to patriarchy. You have to have those as being a core fundamental feature of an intersectional movement that's built on coalitions.
Thanks so much for joining us, Shane.
Yeah, thanks for having me.